You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis, in a place that is known for its surf culture, chilling at the beach, no shoes, no shirts, no jobs, no problems.
Surfing's not a sport, it's a way of life, no hobby. It's a way of looking at that wave and saying, hey bud, let's party.
But here at Topanga Beach, some of the surfers have a different vibe.
I've been one of the ones guilty of like, yeah, get the f*** out of here, kook, you know. I've been cracking people. Like, since I was a kid, like, I was in junior high or something. I broke this dude's nose.
Donnie Wilson is a former pro surfer who's been enforcing local rule at Topanga since the 70s. But Donnie's not alone in his willingness to pick a fight. Over the years, Topanga Beach has developed a reputation for being Topangry. So why are chill surfers sometimes so aggro? And is anyone working to change that? Here's KCRW's Zeke Reed.
Growing up in Topanga, I was scared to surf Topanga Beach, which was a bummer because it's a beautiful spot. Palm trees, a big bay, a lagoon. I mean, it almost looks tropical. Plus, it's widely considered one of the premier point breaks in Southern California. But its locals-only reputation is the stuff of legend. A popular old zine refers to the beach as the Snake Pit. Fights were frequent back in the day, especially between locals and outsiders.
The really heavy guys are the ones that had to pay some real dues to surf here. In the 70s, it would be every time they came surf here, they'd have to fight.
Chad White is another Topanga local.
When I was a kid, like, the old guys kind of put us up to, like, hey, go wax that guy's windows or go, you know, use a BB and flatten that guy's tire.
Decades later, the Topangry mindset still exists. A surfer I spoke to says that during a recent surf session,
I got fully chewed out by a Topangry 12-year-old girl, and I fully got bullied into submission as a 34-year-old man who's surfed here most of my life.
Topanga is far from the only LA surf spot with aggro locals. Just up PCH, at First Point in Malibu, a surfer was recently caught on camera smashing a kid's board with a rock before ditching it in the ocean. Down at Lunada Bay in Palos Verdes, an infamous group of locals known as the Bay Boys would slash tires, throw rocks, and cut leashes of non-local surfers. It took a court order to finally end the mayhem. So what drives folks to such extreme behavior? Simply put, local surfers just don't want to share the waves with outsiders.
If you have too many people trying to go after one limited resource, it doesn't matter what that is in human life, we turn into
Surfing is a selfish sport, as well as a tribal one. And according to surf instructor Cassia Metter, Topanga Beach is an especially tight-knit community.
You have the crew that comes to Topanga all the time, and they all know each other. They all like park in the same spots. They love to catch up with each other, whether there's waves or not. It's like that family at the beach. It's cheers. It's everybody knows your name.
But some surfers feel like their community and culture are under threat. COVID, social media, and decreasing gear costs have led to an explosion in surfing's popularity over the last few years, and local breaks are getting a lot more crowded. Donnie Wilson argues that a spot like Topanga should be protected from kooks, a derogatory term for beginners. For folks who don't surf well, he says,
you just don't go into the VIP room, you know what I mean? You kind of got to show some respect and you kind of got to learn the rules.
Rules like, who's ever closer to the breaking part of the wave gets to take that wave. And don't paddle in front of someone while they're riding. This surf etiquette might not be obvious to folks who just bought their first foam board from Costco. Many experienced surfers I spoke to complained about the lack of awareness amongst beginners. Cassia Metter explains that it creates an unsafe situation for everyone.
I've been put in the hospital by people being blatantly dangerous.
While the concerns about safety and overcrowding are understandable, there are some darker undertones to localism. Perhaps unsurprisingly for a sport that has been dominated by mostly white, mostly affluent men, surfing has its share of bigotry. Enforcing at the beach doesn't always have to involve physical violence. Often, the cues as to who belongs and who doesn't are more subtle.
It's a taste in your mouth. It's a mood that's in the air, that permeates in the air when you paddle over to that point. That you don't belong. And that's if you just get the side eyes and you don't get the vocalization.
That's Joshua Alexander, a black surfer who picked up the sport 2 years ago and regularly surfs Topanga.
Hearing someone shout across from all the way from the top, "Go back to China," at 6 a.m, and it even just saying it, repeating it, hurts.
Run-ins like this underscore the different calculations that surfers of color have to make.
People are always talking about sharks. Like, are you afraid of getting, you know? No, I'm afraid of racism. I'm not afraid of sharks. You know, I don't like racism. I love sharks. Sharks belong in the water. Racism does not.
Joshua is among the folks working to make surfing more inclusive. He's involved with several organizations that help foster community for black and brown surfers, like Ebony Beach Club and Color the Water. Cassia Metter also works with a lot of new surfers, including many women. She believes that creating a culture of mutual respect starts with conversation and education.
Whenever I see people that I feel like are struggling in the water that maybe don't know those couple core key etiquette points that are very important to be aware of, rather than yelling at them like, "Hey, what are you doing?" You know, I try and invite them. "Hey, are you okay? Are you new here? Like, do you need some help and guidance? Can I give you a few pointers?"
She and the other locals recognize that getting to Pangri isn't going to keep kooks from coming to the beach. Even OG local Chad White, who admits to being aggro at times, says that his outlook softened when he started teaching his wife and her friends to surf. However, he's also quick to point out that respect in the water is a two-way street.
It's not just like we, as the people that have been surfing here, need to just be all of a sudden be nice to everybody. It's etiquette. It's understanding how this thing operates. It's an ecosystem.
And with any ecosystem, there's going to be a pecking order. That's something that Joshua, the black surfer working to make surfing more inclusive, also acknowledges, recognizing the hypocrisy of inviting more people into the water while still wanting to claim the best waves. After our conversation on the beach, Joshua and I paddled out together. We watched another novice surfer miss a few waves. And so, when the next set came, Joshua cut in front of him. When the guy inevitably complained, Joshua turned to me, smiled, and said, "Don't get me wrong. I'm also part of the problem." For KCRW, I'm Zeke Reed.
Special thanks to Frankie Seeley for help on reporting this story.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, you just heard about how aggressive California surfers can be historically, even into the modern day. But let's go back to the 50s and 60s when problematic faves like Mickey Dora ruled the waves. And take a step back into that golden era of surfing in a new book. Melanie Benjamin has a novel called California Golden, set on the sandy beaches of Malibu in the late 1960s. Her novel explores what happens when a trailblazing surfer neglects her two daughters. And Melanie is with us right now. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We're talking about a surfer named Carol Donnelly. Number one, unusual in that time, right? Because Carol Donnelly is a female surfer.
That's correct. Very unusual.
And a famous one at that. Like a really good one.
And the mother. Yeah. I mean, those things didn't happen very often.
Well, the mom and surfer, Carol Donnelly, has two daughters, Mindy and Ginger. You open the book from their perspectives, right? Their individual perspectives before you transition to Carol's perspective in the last, say, third of the book. Why'd you do it that way? Why'd you decide to explore the family's relationships that way?
Well, yeah, no, I didn't. I mean, I started out with a traditional, we were going to hear from each individual person alternating chapters, so there'd be three points of view. But every time I got to Carol's story, it seemed to me the book dragged a bit at that point, that Mindy and Ginger, you know, they're very different journeys through the 1960s, one through the counterculture, one through the cult, you know, more pop culture thing. That was so compelling that I didn't want to be dragged back into the 40s, which was where Carol's story begins. And I also like the idea that we only get to know Carol, who seems like a monster, through her daughter's eyes. And then at a certain point when the daughters are old enough to maybe appreciate where what her mother was dealing with, trying to break out of the stereotypes of the 1940s and 1950s, then we get Carol's story. And while learning about her and iconic women like her who did not want to be Donna Reed, I thought we may not excuse the things she does to her daughters, the neglect mainly, but at least we might understand that for every trailblazing woman out there, you know, there's a sacrifice to be made and there are people who will get hurt. And, you know, the collateral damage is the daughters. But we can still applaud Carol for trying to break out and pursue her athletic passion.
For you, if you are under 50 years old, you probably don't know who Donna Reed is. So let me explain. She's a housewife, yeah. Right? She is the homemaker.
Yeah, the housewives, the June Cleavers, yeah. the Harriet Nelsons of those 1950s sitcoms, right?
Yeah. Ginger Donnelly, I want to read this one part, which refers to one of the daughters, Ginger. This is the counterculture daughter, right?
Yeah,
this
the daughter who cannot quite keep up with her athletic and star mother and sister.
And sister, yeah. Who also surfs. Now, she says this, that the ocean was the primary part of both the plan and the problem seemed inevitable because the ocean was pretty much her first memory. And she knew somehow, even when she was only a little girl, just beginning to think of the future beyond what sandwich she was going to have for lunch or what TV show she and Mindy would watch that evening, that it would be her last. I hone in on that because I want to ask you, how much did the ocean factor into the family dynamic? It's kind of the main character, right? The ocean.
The ocean, yeah. Well, I think that the ocean and surfing is a great metaphor for life anyway. There are times you catch that perfect wave and you ride it in and you're on top of the world, but then there are times you wipe out miserably. You can't predict it. It's unpredictable, but it's always moving. And on the surface, it's shiny and pretty, and on below, there are some dark things. And I just think that was a apt metaphor for these girls' lives.
Throughout the book, you underscore also this racial tension that's going on. This is the 50s and 60s, obviously. Not to say that it's much different today, to be quite honest, in America. Now, this is surrounding Mindy's relationship, one of the girls, with Jimmy Cho, who's a surfer from Hawaii.
Right.
We often think of, you know, when it comes to racism, Jim Crow in the South. But your book really kind of reveals an ugly truth about California as well, and particularly about the surfing culture.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, how surfing became synonymous with white California teenagers, that's a real mystery. But since it started in Polynesia.
Yeah.
But, you know, when we do talk about surfing, and it's certainly great strides are being made today, but it is cultural appropriation, you know, pure and simple. And Jimmy Cho represents, you know, that the native Hawaiian perspective, you know, his anger, I think, at some of his, you know, his ancestors perhaps being too welcoming of the white people in Hawaii, and his anger that this, you know, spiritual Hawaiian custom, you know, part of their spiritual world is now, you know, co-opted by all these white people in California. So I really thought it was important to include that point of view, and that he is, and he has a very big role to play in the lives of both of these sisters. And I thought that was really intriguing, too. But yeah, I mean, you don't think of California being, you know, you think of it being more, you know, more progressive. But, you know, it's not, because it's in the United States. And so we certainly do, and especially in that era, we certainly do see the ramifications of Mindy's choosing to pursue a relationship with him to the point where it can kill her career.
Well, Melanie is in San Diego today and tomorrow, but she'll be reading at Chaucer's Bookstore in Santa Barbara come Monday. For more information on the book and other related events, you can go to our website, kcrw.com/GLA. Melanie Benjamin, thanks for coming on, and congratulations on the new book.
Well, thank you very much. And you know, just what a great conversation. It's refreshing to talk to someone who's actually read the book.
Still to come, the black walnut tree of Northeast LA is in trouble. Good thing there are good folks not only harvesting those nuts, but also making sure the trees live on for generations. It's yours after this short break. Moving on now with Greater LA from KCRW, I'm Steve Chiatakis. If you've ever taken a stroll through the hillsides of Northeast LA, at Debs Park, for example, or maybe at Flat Top or Ascot Hills, you might have noticed some scrappy greenish-yellow trees with clusters of heavy black nuts weighing down those branches. Those are California's native black walnuts, and right now is their peak season. For centuries, those trees have played an essential role in LA's local ecosystems and its indigenous cultures. But climate change and development have taken a toll, and now some local environmental groups are fighting to protect and even repopulate them before it's too late. This weekend, a coalition of those groups will kick off the neighborhood's second annual Black Walnut Festival. It's an event that aims to celebrate the tree and to get more folks involved in saving it. And KCRW's Zoe Matthew tagged along on a recent walnut gathering excursion.
Here's our first big walnut tree on our little hike here. You can see that it is fruiting. Where are they? There's one there. What do y'all notice about the walnuts on this one?
They're pretty green.
This one's yellow. Black up there.
It has some spots, and one of them is changing color.
So they're not black as they are like in the name. Because this one doesn't look ready, we're not gonna collect from it. We're gonna let it do its thing. And kind of give it a chance to provide for the wildlife first. We can start moving and seeing if there are any that are ready, hopefully.
The SoCal black walnut tree is kind of an overlooked tree, and there's so many special things about it. I'm Brenda Contreras, and this is my partner, Micah Hasurgian, and we're both part of the NELA Black Walnut Day Committee. We're also part of Coyotwan Masewali.
We're a local nonprofit based out of Northeast LA that focuses on defending the hillsides here and protecting open spaces and gathering community together for land stewardship.
As we were defending these hillsides in Northeast LA, one of the things that kept on coming up were that this is black walnut habitat. And so we saw that the city wasn't doing enough to protect this species.
So it's a protected tree under the Los Angeles Tree Protection Ordinance, but it doesn't really do anything to mitigate the loss of the trees because you could just replace them with another species. So basically, the city of Los Angeles has been granting permits to remove one mature black walnut tree per week, essentially. And that's only the permitted removals.
It's home for over 30 species of birds, migratory birds, native birds. It's also a food source for a lot of mammals. One of the things that immediately like stands out is that it doesn't have like a regular trunk that goes straight up. It has multiple trunks that branch out and kind of fan out. And during the winter, its leaves fall down. So a lot of folks don't like it because of that. They think it's ugly. But it's not. It's an amazing tree that reminds us, like its characteristics are a reminder of its resiliency and how it's lasted for so long.
It could be like burned down to the ground pretty much, it can be cut, and then it could sprout up to a large size like in a short period of time. You know, a lot of people have grown up around these trees their whole lives, but they never really knew what they were, their significance, and you know, I think learning about their resilience is really inspirational for a lot of these folks who are facing displacement or, you know, different issues where they can, you know, see the lessons that the black walnut teach us.
Yeah, as we see these trees being cut down, we know like we need to support them, and the best way to support them is to keep them intact, and the second best is to start planting and do reforestation efforts. And so the harvesting, then we do ethical harvesting, and we clean up the walnuts and sprout them, propagate them. We tend them in micro nurseries throughout Northeast LA, and then return them to the land.
They're taking a walnut branch and trying to jostle the walnuts down.
Yeah, they're really high up.
We found one. I mean, I guess that's the walnut harvesting as a whole.
This is going to be our cleaning side, and then this is going to be our potting side. We have some walnuts from last year that have been stratified and are ready to be potted. How to clean them? Do you want to do that?
So I usually do it with my hands, but there's like kitchen knives. I literally just take it out. We're collecting all the husk because this is how traditionally native people, especially Tongva, would use the husk to dye different things. So, you know, you can kind of scratch as much as you want. Be careful, they're not too sharp, but. So once it's nice and clean, we're gonna go ahead and have a bucket with water, and we're gonna get a small brush and just try to get as much of the black stuff off.
Probably.
I mean,
cool.
I think it's cool.
Yeah, I don't know.
Natural, organic.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I really want to try dyeing.
Mi hija. Netwanya netin or duno kaderon komikrabet naha tongve koi mixkanakan koyo eme. Hello, I am Tinor Duno Calderon. I'm Gabrielino Tongva, Ventureño Chumash, and yo eme. The black walnut for our people, it's medicine in a way beyond ahikin, beyond the wind, beyond the breath of life. All parts of it are really important, not only for the humans, but for the animals. First of all, it provides food. Second of all, it provides medicine. And third of all, the aspect of being able to use it for paint and pigments. When the Europeans got here, they didn't think it was enough. It was like, that's too much work to try to get into that hard shell to only get this little bit. So they came and they grafted our trees with the Eastern walnut to make them bigger. So you'll see a whole variety in this area. You'll see the traditional ones that are very small. And then you'll see some that are a little bit bigger, but they have, when you crack them open, they look just like a California walnut, only bigger. For us, we were perfectly happy with the taste of it and how much you get out of it. And because we also don't waste anything, we would reuse and repurpose the shell. And so we would make a dice game out of it. So we would take the empty shell and we would fill it with asphaltum, which is a natural occurring tar. And then we would decorate it with little tiny pieces of abalone. Part of it for us is singing songs. So this one goes, Nishuna Weshko, Nishuna Weshko, Nishuna, 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 Nishuna Weshko, Dwa'a Nehino Tehovemo. And we would let the dice go. And so that's just one verse of the song. The end part of it, Tua'a Nehino Tehovemo, means that we're counting our blessings. Nature has its way of continuing. It will continue, right, with or without the human's help. But it's really good that these environmental orgs are stepping up to do this, because on these last few hills that are left is where they're cutting them down with disregard to it. Even though technically it's supposed to be, it's not really endangered, but it's at risk. And so they should have that respect for it. But there's no way that anyone is like punishing them for doing what they're doing. And that's why the humans are stepping in to replant them so that they can come back.
That was Brenda Contreras, Micah Hasurgian, and Tina Orduno Calderon. Tawny de Guzman and C. Javier Rodriguez helped lead that black walnut harvest event. If you want to celebrate this tree yourself, you can head on over to the Tecape Washoot Northeast LA Black Walnut Day celebration, which is this Sunday at Ascot Hills Park in El Sereno, and learn more about the hikes and harvests and workshops organized by the group Coyot Juan Masiwali by heading on over to our website, kcrw.com/GLA. That's it for today. Tomorrow, at this time, The Business with Kim Masters, the filmmakers behind the Academy Award-winning documentary Navalny. The director and the investigative journalist share why they moved up the premiere and how they navigated making that doc. It's an encore presentation of The Business tomorrow at 1 and 6. Next week on this program, a transitional housing program for trans people helps them stabilize their lives. Meet one resident who's building a new life there. Coming up Monday on GLA, always online, by the way, at kcrw.com/GLA. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthews, Zeke Reed, Celine Mendiola, Phil Richards, John Meek, Sonia Geis, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordall all help make the show happen. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your time. Thanks for that ear. Have a great night.